This is an ABC podcast.
Morena, Manuela Tayao, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We bring our show to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. What's on the show today? Well, guess what? It has been a full-on week covering the elections in the Solomon Islands, but now the counting of votes is underway. But the results may not be known for another week or two, so we'll get the latest from our reporter, Evan Wasuka. There's controversy over the cause of a death for a young trans woman in Fiji and the search for a World War II plane. That takes us to Papua New Guinea. More on these stories shortly, but you'll be able to find them online once our show is done. Simply type into your search engine Pacific Beat Radio Australia and feel free to share these stories across all your social media platforms. Remember, follow and like our page ABC Pacific on Facebook and Instagram. But I'm Aggie Dubol and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Well, vote counting will start in Solomon Islands in a few hours' time following yesterday's general elections. Officials say polling was peaceful across the country and it could take more than a week before ballots are tallied. Now the country waits to see if there will be a change of political leadership. Our reporter, Evan Wasuka, was on the ground yesterday speaking with voters who were excited to exercise their democratic rights for the first time in 5 years.
When you go, you check him, this blue, you are there blue, you make sure you check him now, page blue, very important.
The sun had only just risen, but already polling booths had begun to fill. With the energy high, voters like Central Honiara local Adam were enthusiastic about casting their ballot.
There's a mood for change. We need a change in this country. Maybe we change the system or maybe we change the members in the parliament. That's the change we looking for.
John Iroga began lining up at 5 a.m. for the chance to vote, saying he's doing it for his kids.
It's important because our future is not in our leaders. Some of us who have kids, it's the future of our kids we're worried about. We have to make the right decision in our voting.
300 candidates are contesting 50 seats in parliament, and another 900 are contesting provincial seats. Three wards declared winners quickly in Kukum, Anuta, and Tirotonga wards.
We now have the first three declarations of winners for the joint election 2024. All three winners were unopposed, and all three are from the provincial wards and Honiara City Council ward.
As more results come in, the newly selected MPs will travel to Honiara to form coalitions and vote for the Prime Minister's position. Caretaker Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare is hoping to return for a second back-to-back term. But he first has to overcome competition from three other candidates in his home seat in Choiseul Province. Across the day, voters like Eugene in Honiara voiced a similar theme.
It's important to vote because I want a new member of parliament and for him to help the country. It feels good to vote new.
In the lead-up to the election, Solomon Islands has faced a tumultuous 5 years with political riots, concerns about geopolitics, and the pandemic. This is the first election since Honiara switched diplomatic allegiance from Taipei to Beijing in 2019. It's a relationship Manasseh Sogavare has highlighted in his campaign as a selling point and an issue that has seen John Amitau come out to vote for the first time.
5 minutes to four and I just cast my vote. Yeah, feeling high. First time. I'm 55 years old, but it's my first time to cast a vote. And it's a special because it's both for the National Parliament and Honiara Town Council. So
he says he'll be keeping a close eye on who the next leader is and how they handle the relationship with China.
We have just done the switch. So really, really looking forward at who will come into power and see we continue with the China thing or we switch back to Taiwan or we look for another whichever country of power that we wish to engage here in Solomon Island. As recently, lately, we've seen China really pouring in the aids. And at the moment, I'm sure China is trying to influence in some way. But then I know that the security part of it, Australia, New Zealand, even the US are coming in, you know, inside of security too. So I'm really looking at the security side of things.
And as the crowd swelled across the day, teams of international observers were on site to closely monitor. Logistically, it's a huge operation, with around 700,000 people in the country and 420,000 people registered to vote, spread out across hundreds of islands and atolls. Police from Australia, New Zealand and Papua New Guinea were on hand to assist local police in case of unrest. The Royal Solomon Islands Police Force commended the public on a peaceful turnout. Electoral CEO Jasper Anisi says polling day went according to plan.
So far, I would like to thank everyone for respecting each other's right. Our initial report shows that all polling was progressing as planned across the country. Our morning reports indicate that there was no significant incident.
While the morning saw a large and hurried turnout, by afternoon the crowds had dwindled before polls closed at 4 o'clock local time. And as the sun set, many voters, like Adam, returned home, satisfied with carrying out their democratic rights.
The exercise of democracy is very important to keep the strength and power of this country. Democracy is very important, so the voting is very important.
And that's Honiara voter Adam ending that report from Evan Wasuka and with production support from Jordan Fennell. Well, joining us now is Evan Wasuka there in Honiara. With that, I say good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning, Aggie. I am good, recovering after a day of election coverage yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, though. What happens now, Evan? Because what's the next step with the voting now complete?
Well, Aggie, yesterday evening, the ballot boxes were collected and they were put into secured storage with police. Now, this is all across the country. And at around 9 a.m. today, vote counting will start. And it's quite a long process, as there's certainly a lot of votes to count. Officials here are estimating that it could take up to between, well, they're scheduled for a week and a half, but it might go a bit longer than that. So it'll start off with the process of verifying the ballot boxes before vote counting actually starts. Now, all this will happen at counting centers. So there's a couple around Honiara near to me. And as part of the process, they'll have teams divided between counting the national votes and those counting the provincial votes. They're expecting provincial seats to be announced first before the national ones. Yesterday, there were three provincial seats that were announced. This was because these seats in Honiara, Isabel and Aotemaleta, they only had one candidate each contesting that seat, so it was uncontested. So they're among the first to be celebrating wins in the elections here in the Solomons. Looking at the big national seats that will be coming out, we're expecting from Friday onwards. The seats in Choiseul province, which is where the Prime Minister is, that's expected to be among the first ones to be counted. And the reason is Choiseul province and Western province, they didn't have elections for their provincial seats. So only the national seats have been counted. And those are expected to come through possibly Friday, if not throughout the week after that.
Yeah. Even are you hoping that you could be there at the counting centres, though?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I'll be here in Honiara in one of the counting centres marking the opening just to see what's happening. I'm sure there's also plenty of interest from locals. Inside the centre, there'll be, along with the media, there'll also be political party agents who'll be watching the process to verify that everything is going according to protocol. And others, there'll also be election observers. Aggie, there were more than 300 international and domestic observers here going through the elections yesterday. They were quite visible. I saw observers from the Pacific Islands Forum, the Melanesian Spearhead Group, even the G7 had observers here. And, of course, there were domestic observers as well. And another big group of observers was from the Australian National University. They're working with the National University here as part of the observer program. Earlier this morning, I caught up with James Batley, and he's leading this ANU and CNU observer group. And I got to speak to him and talk to him about what did he make of yesterday's elections, and did everything go according to plan? This is a bit of what James Batley had to say.
My early impression is that it went very well. We've got some teams in pretty remote parts of the country, and we actually haven't heard directly from all of them yet. But those teams we heard from, and from my own observations in quite a few polling stations in Honiara, was that the process worked very well, that many polling stations were virtually empty by early in the afternoon. Most people who had wanted to vote had been able to vote. And it looked to us that polling officials were very much on top of their responsibilities and were controlling the polling stations very well.
In the past, we've seen issues around missing names, questions over ballot papers. Were there any things that cropped up during yesterday's elections that you saw?
So, as I was saying, we'll still be analysing all of our data, but my impression is that the organisation this time was pretty good, that people understood that they should come and they'd see their photograph and their name posted outside each polling station, and that would let them know or confirm that that was the polling station they should vote at. I observed, I think, a small handful of cases where people presented themselves to the polling officials and were told, no, you're not registered here. But as I say, that was a very small minority. We will want to put all those figures together, of course, and come up with a more definitive conclusion in the days to come.
In terms of turnout, I was around quite early in the morning. There was big crowds. I got to vote later in the afternoon. It was very empty. Is this what we've seen in the past?
It's certainly what we saw, what I saw in 2019, where there was, around the country, the participation rate was something like 86%. And certainly yesterday people turned up early. They wanted to vote early. It's possible the rain yesterday might have affected some people in Honiara, but as I say, by the end of the afternoon, if you wanted to vote, you certainly had every opportunity. I didn't see any examples of people that were stuck in long queues or anything like that.
Now, looking ahead to vote counting, what's your plan with the observers?
Well, as we have teams in 15 different constituencies around the country, and in the coming week they will be doing two things. They'll be observing the vote count in their respective constituencies, but they'll also be interviewing citizens to continue the program of research that the ANU and Solomon Islands National University team have been conducting over the last week or so. So those dual tasks, and then our teams will come back from the field, as I say, in about a week's time.
And will they be observing right to the end of counting? Because it might be more than a week.
Yeah, well, we'll just take it day by day. Certainly we would not want to leave the counting in the lurch, so we'll see how that goes.
And that's James Batley, leader of the ANU Election Observers at the Solomon Islands elections. Evan, an interesting point he did make of people showing up early to cast their vote. I'm wondering, that must signify a positive note on how much people really value their democratic right.
Yeah, we certainly saw the crowds rush in earlier in the early part of the day. So I think in general, people are very happy to cast their votes. I walked around and I saw and I spoke to different people, and they're really keen that they had this opportunity to have a say in, you know, in how the national government operates and in choosing their leader. So people are certainly happy to be participating in the elections here.
And even in your earlier report, obviously you spoke to, you know, quite a few people of the community talking about the change, the future for their kids. Is that still, does that seem to be the general consensus?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really hard to gauge, but people do want change. But, you know, in past elections, I've also seen people calling for change. It's quite a common theme here in the Solomon Islands, people wanting change, wanting a better development, I suppose, improvements in health, education, jobs, particularly for the younger voters. They're keen for employment opportunities. So it's certainly something voters here we were calling for when yesterday. And again, in all the rushing around, I did manage to go and cast my vote in East Honiara, which is my constituency on the eastern side of the capital.
Nice. Well, I'm glad you were able to cast your vote, Evan. We appreciate the hard work that you've been doing there, especially always having to cross with us every morning and report and let us know what has been happening.
Oh, always happy to keep everyone updated on all the going-ons here. Yep, there's quite a big number of team. Well, not big, but there's certainly a number of us from the ABC here in town. Mm. We have Chris and Rita Amandu-Leong, our Honiara-based reporter, plus Stephen Jajitz, the ABC's foreign affairs reporter, has also been filing back to the ABC platforms right throughout the week as well.
Well, let's hope that you can have a little bit of rest before you return home. But again, thank you very much, Evan, for keeping us up to date.
Thank you, Aggie.
No worries. That, of course, is our reporter live there in Honiara, Evan Wasuka. Pacific Beat. Well, we head to Fiji now, where its LGBTQI plus community is devastated by the possibility that a young trans woman who died last month at the Lautoka Hospital may have been the victim of a hate crime. Fiji police initially said 19-year-old Esther Ravato died from complications connected to an existing medical condition. But an associate has filed a police complaint alleging Ms. Ravato went to hospital after being beaten up by a group of people in a neighbouring town. Ratu Eroni Dina from the Trans Affirmative Action Guard believes it is not safe for gender diverse people in Fiji.
So it feels like one of our children has just been robbed of the opportunity to simply thrive and be gorgeous and be beautiful. 19 years old, Livia, and this child was literally taken away from us just for simply existing. This is not the first person from the LGBT community, from our community, and more specifically, this is not the first trans person that has died at the hands of someone who took things into their own hands and killed a trans person they did not even know. So there was a lot of sadness, and then it was, of course, followed by a lot of anger. So I also can openly say that I am also scared as a trans-identifying person myself, not only for myself. I'm scared for members of our community who are consistently and continuously exposed to these kinds of violations over and over again, and it continues to go unheard and unseen. I need not remind people of the cases that usually grow cold and take forever to solve, especially when it has to deal with somebody from our community. No one should ever have to fear for their safety or face violence simply for being who they are. And yet, there, the reality is, every time a trans-diverse person, a vaxa-leo-leo-identifying person, wakes up every morning, unlike a straight person, they have to juggle and make compromises because they're concerned about their safety and security every time they step out of the door. Why are we normalizing that human beings have to make those compromises every morning just to be safe? If that's the country that we live in, it's sad that we continue to turn a blind eye and we're not making any investments into shifting these mindsets and changes, that we're living in a much more peaceful environment. No one should ever have to fear for the safety or face violence simply for being who they are. So it is incumbent upon all members of society, including the media and all of the authorities, to keep challenging harmful stereotypes. My message to the LGBTQI community, the trans community, the Vaxa-Leo-Leo community, is be safe. Do not go anywhere alone. We live in a country that is no longer safe for people like us.
and that's Ratu Eroni Dina from the Trans Affirmative Action Guard. Now, the ABC understands police have now put together a task force to investigate Ms. Ravato's death following a public outcry. In a statement earlier this week, Fiji police said medical authorities had concluded an existing condition led to Ms. Ravato's death, but they will pursue the allegations of assault and gather further statements from medical authorities. The Minister for Home Affairs, Pio Dekotuandua, revealed to Lede Movono that the medical condition was epilepsy. He does not believe Ms. Ravato's death was a hate crime.
I don't know what is the nature of the injuries that he sustained. No, they are continuing to conduct the assault investigation because that was what was complained about, that he was assaulted and that's the cause of death.
Why has it taken the police this long to give us an update?
Okay, I really don't know because all I've heard about this case was when it was in the papers, you see, because I inquired about it. All I know is I've told the commissioner that he should investigate the assault. Someone is kicking up something that makes references to the assault. It's the cause of death, so he needs to get to the bottom of it, as opposed to what the doctor wrote on the, and I'm not reporting.
Does it worry you that a part of our community feel that there is hate crime being perpetrated against them?
See, no one must be subjected to any crime at all. Full stop. Hate is only hate. No one deserves it. That's the bottom line. We must speak out against it, I know they are, I'm hearing what you are saying, but any crime is any crime. No one should really be prejudiced because of what kind of orientation they have. You know what I mean? One's right, every human right, is enshrined in the Constitution. If something like that has happened, then it has to be investigated, be treated like any other case.
Would you be willing to sit with the members of the NGO Coalition on Human Rights to hear their concerns about what they say is an increase in hate crimes?
I'm open to everybody. I'm concerned that is what they're thinking. I hope that it is not true that because of his orientation, the police, have kind of treated the case lesser than the consideration for any other kind of similar crime. But I don't think it is. The police are actually doing that. I don't think it is.
And that's Fiji's Minister for Home Affairs, Pio Dekotuandua, speaking to Lede Movono.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, there's alarm in the Cook Islands over a proposed cryptocurrency legislation that could grant the government sweeping powers to seize financial assets in any part of the world. The law is called the Tainted Cryptocurrency Recovery Bill 2023, and according to an investigation by One News, it's drafted by an American debt-collecting company, Drumcliff. But critics say its wording is so broad that it could potentially authorise hacking into government and university systems around the world. So for more on this, I'm joined now by Jeff Nicey, a cryptocurrency expert and senior lecturer in engineering, computer and mathematical sciences at AUT University. With that, I say good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Jeff, you've read the bill. Can you understand why people are alarmed by what's being proposed?
I've read the bill. It's quite lengthy, and really this is quite a mess, to be clear. And it basically sets the scene for a gross violation of citizen privacy across the board.
Okay, so what would actually allow the government for it to, what could they do?
Well, there's a large section here that establishes the basis for what they're calling ethical recovery hacking. So this is a contradiction, right? Saying that they're going to hack into systems that perhaps could be related to cryptocurrency, and they're going to do it in an ethical manner, which is a contradiction. And there's one particular part that says that it grants the users of the bill the authority to bypass authorization and authentication mechanisms. And this is basically just cracking people's passwords, right? And, citizens have passwords for their own privacy into all of their systems and apps. And this would allow them to bypass it just under the premise of looking for cryptocurrency.
Wow. Well, one, we'd have to understand what their definition of ethical is. And then, is this actually realistically enforceable?
Well, the problem with cryptocurrency is that it's not something that you can just hack into and seize, as is projected in the bill. So I think it's a bit misleading, both to lawmakers and to citizens, by saying that, you know, they can identify weaknesses and then they can seize cryptocurrency, you know, which would be the proceeds of crime. When really cryptocurrency, as the crypto is in the name, it's protected by cryptography. And so nobody can seize anyone's cryptocurrency. And, you know, reading between the lines, this means that you would have to coerce people into either cooperating or involuntarily giving up their passwords or their keys to this cryptocurrency.
I was just going to say, how would they be able to seize assets in other countries?
So the way that it works, if you look around some of the other cases where cryptocurrency assets are recovered, it's always people cooperating with lawyers and people cooperating with the asset recovery team. And that means that the people have decided that, look, you know, I don't want to run away and skirt the law on this one, so I'm going to give up access to all of our accounts. And there's no other way around it. You have to work with law enforcement, or you have to essentially have your data stolen, which is what the bill is setting it up. And they're doing it under the premise that they're trying to catch bad actors. But actually, it's so broad sweeping that it's going to affect anyone that wants to use cryptocurrency.
If you've just joined our show, Pacific Beat, speaking with cryptocurrency expert Jeff Nicey on a very confusing cryptocurrency bill that is about to come out there for the Cook Islands. Jeff, is there any other country or even a government that's taken this approach to cryptocurrency enforcement?
There isn't, and I'll tell you exactly what. Why? It's because it wouldn't make it through Parliament. The way that it stands now, and to be clear, I'm not a lawyer, but I do have it on, I have heard from lawyers, you know, that it's essentially a mess and it's not going to work. And it's just too broad of a bill. And the other thing is that a lot of countries already have appropriate legislation to deal with financial crimes. And so the cryptocurrency portion is usually slotted into that appropriate legislation that's already in place.
Yeah, well, there's already, again, as you say, a lot of criticism, but criticism towards it being levied at the Cook Islands government over its enlisting of Drumcliffe, which is an American company, of course, to draft these laws. What can you say are the potential implications of this arrangement?
Right, so the idea of, you know, granting this authority to a third party, it's okay in the sense that you're going to need experts that know what they're doing to deal with this. But on the other hand, what they're doing here is they're setting up this third party, which is operating as a business, and that's the for-profit business. And so now you've changed the lens, and now you're saying that this business, which is not necessarily, you know, looking out for the Cook Islands, is in the business, in the for-profit business of seizing cryptocurrency. So as a business, they're going to look for areas that they can, you know, search and try to find crypto that can be seized. And oh, by the way, we're going to, you know, bring the Cook Islands along with us, or we're going to say that we're doing it for the benefit of the Cook Islands. And so I think that's really problematic, is having this a for-profit business essentially searching for assets to seize.
Does this then, Jeff, reflect broader anxieties about cryptocurrency crime? Because, I mean, how vulnerable is Cook Islands without a legal response such as the one it's proposing?
I think the vulnerability comes in terms of their reputation. And so, you know, if it gets set up as is, it might be quite difficult to unwind and come back from. And, you know, that reputation can be very difficult to patch up on the fly as you go.
So then what do you think the answer is then moving forward?
Well, I think that we do need to identify that there can be crime along with cryptocurrency, but this isn't a whole lot different from other financial crime that maybe doesn't use cryptocurrency. And so at the moment, we're in a tricky situation, you know, legislators and governments all over. And the situation is that we don't want citizens to fall victim to a number of scams. We recently saw a press release from the Central Bank of Fiji. And the other piece is that we don't really have a good method of handling this because cryptocurrency is such a new industry. And so, you know, certainly let's propose legislation, but let's also, you know, have appropriate due process, people comment on it and work it out that way. But it is a tough situation because cryptocurrency is such a new industry.
Yeah, what do you think would allow this to actually not go through?
I think the part that would allow it to not go through is a violation of privacy. This idea of ethical hacking straight away, it's couched in this context that we're going to catch criminals. And really, I think, you know, to be honest, when you look at the number of, like, the volume of seized crypto assets that perhaps could benefit the Cook Islands, so there's a part of the bill that says we're going to take proceeds and we're essentially going to convert it into dollars and put it in the Cook Islands account. And I think that is very unlikely. You're not going to see a large benefit for the Cook Islands in that sense. And so to me it's a front such that they can go about this ethical hacking. And I don't think that is going to make it pass.
Yeah, it does sound there's obviously a lot more negative implications that could come out of this rather than anything positive. Jeff, look, we really appreciate your time. I think this is something that we will need to dive into a little bit more and get some more info about. But we appreciate your time in giving us a bit of insight into this.
Great. Thank you very much.
No worries. That, of course, is cryptocurrency expert and a senior lecturer in engineering, computer and mathematical sciences at the AUT University, Jeff Nicey, here on Pacific Beat. Stay tuned. We will have your news wrap shortly. Yes, good fella morning. It is that time where we head around the Pacific, around the region, to know what is happening within our beautiful nations. Of course, it's brought to you by our producer, Mackenzie Smith, joining us this morning. Morena, Mackenzie.
Morning, Aggie.
Wow, we get into the Great Barrier Reef. They're facing what could be its worst summer of coral bleaching yet. What's happening?
Yeah, unfortunately, a new summer snapshot report released by the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority and the Australian Institute of Marine Science says that compared with previous summers, cumulative impacts have been much higher this summer and a widespread bleaching event is still unfolding. So according to The Guardian, the report says 39% of more than 1,000 individual reefs as part of the Great Barrier have experienced either very high or extreme levels of bleaching in what could be the worst summer on record. The Great Barrier Reef is currently in its fifth mass bleaching event in just 8 years, driven by a warming climate.
Wow. Well, let's head to Papua New Guinea, where the government is looking at cracking down on private debt for its public servants. What's behind this?
Yeah, so these concerns stem from some fairly stark figures. At least 94,000 or 70% of public servants in PNG are living in heavy private debt to loan sharks. That's according to the Public Service Minister, Joseph Sungi. The national newspaper reports him saying he's seeking legal amendments to prevent public servants from taking on more private debt, instead looking at capping loan repayments to 50% of their salary, which is obviously still a lot. So many small finance companies in PNG will only loan to public servants, making them a primary market in that space.
And finally, Fiji's military says it will seek a dialogue with past leaders removed from power in military coups. What is happening there?
Well, last month, for context, the Republic of Fiji military forces commander, Major General Jone Koloniwai, said the institution was going to set out to redeem itself, and that included him asking soldiers in a speech to reach out to those they had wronged in the past and set things right. So the Fiji Times now reports Koloniwai saying when this internal process is complete, The RFMF will engage with former political leaders and their families who were deposed in Fiji's coups in 1987, 2000 and 2006. And Koloni Wai said they were also providing trauma support to the families of the four soldiers who died in the 2000 coup.
Wow, that is a big move. Well, look, Mackenzie, thank you very much for bringing us our news wrap this morning.
No worries.
That is our producer, Mackenzie Smith, with your news wrap this morning here on Pacific Beat.
Join me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. Wow, a search to find a plane which belonged to America's top World War II fighter pilot will get underway in Papua New Guinea next month. An American museum has partnered with a historical preservation group to find the P-38 fighter which belonged to Medal of Honor winner Richard Bong. Bong is famous for shooting down 40 Japanese aircrafts during the war before engine failure sent the plane crashing into the jungle. Brianna Fiant from the Bong Veterans Historical Center in Wisconsin told Carl Evans its recovery will honour the memory of the pilot and allow her museum to establish closer ties to PNG.
Richard Bong was America's ace of aces, so that means that he shot down more enemy planes than any of our other pilots in World War II. And in fact, he holds that record even past World War II. No one has ever beaten him. He shot down 40 planes in the Pacific Theater flying the P-38 Lightning.
40 planes. And where within the Pacific did he serve?
So he started in Port Moresby in the Buna and the Buna area in New Guinea. And then he worked his way up the coast of New Guinea as they were pushing the Japanese back. And by the time his tours, he did three tours. And by the time his last one was done, they were in the Philippines.
Yeah, wow. Now, there is a really exciting initiative that you currently have going. I understand you're going to go search for the same plane that he flew in way back in the Second World War, which was shot down. Can you tell us a little bit about the search and how you're going to go about it?
Sure. So he flew many planes, actually, during the war. But the most famous one he flew was one that he attached a picture of his girlfriend Marge to, and he named the plane Marge. So the plane was being flown by a different pilot at the time that it crashed. So, and that pilot did survive as well. So it wasn't Richard Bong who crashed the plane, but he did crash in the Madang area. So now we are sending an expedition to go find that plane. We have a general idea of where it is. 32nd Infantry Division found the plane crash within a couple days of the crash, so they know, they documented where the site was, but really nobody has gone back officially and tried to locate it.
Excellent. So how do you plan to go about finding it? I imagine it's probably sunk to the bottom of the ocean somewhere, and it's been there for 80 years.
So no, it did crash on land, so it's not underwater. So this is why we partnered with a group called Pacific Rex. They have been doing this for 30 years. They have found thousands of planes over in the Pacific Theater. And so we're not too worried about being able to find the location, but what we find could be anything. It could be from nothing there because it was washed away in a mudslide, or it could be parts of the prop and the engine. And of course, in my dreams at night, I think that we're going to find the part of the picture of his girlfriend, Marge. So we'll see.
Yeah, I understand that Marge, that was the name of the plane. And it also had some particular markings on it as well. Is that right?
Yes. So it had the picture, his girlfriend's graduation photo was on there, and her name. And then every time a pilot would shoot down a Japanese plane, they would get a Japanese flag sticker on the side of their plane. So he had, at the time he was flying her, he had 27 of those flags on his plane as well.
And can you tell us a little bit about the significance of what it would mean to your museum and your community if you found the plane?
For us, it's about bringing Richard Bong back into the national conscious, I hope. I hope that people will relearn who he is and the role that he played in the war. He was extremely famous in the United States during World War II, and I would love him to get the recognition he deserves again. And I think particularly for the family, Richard Bong still has two sisters that are still alive. I think to find the plane crash site and be able to tell them about it would be so meaningful for me.
And would you want to return parts of the plane to be able to house in your museum back in Wisconsin?
No, we are going over there strictly to document the site and take video and photographic footage. But we are not looking to bring any of the plane back that belongs to New Guinea. And we want to be very respectful of the New Guinea people, and this is their history too. So we have no interest in coming in bringing the plane back.
Yeah, and speaking of the New Guinea people, if the plane is indeed there, I'm sure it's been spotted maybe once or twice over the years. Will you engage with the local population at all to see if they might have perhaps seen anything?
Yes, that is actually my secondary goal, other than finding the plane, is to establish longer-term connections with some of the people over there. I would love to become sister cities with the city that's closest to the plane wreck. And I would love to establish a connection with the National Museum. And I would love to just work with the people going forward, not just for this one event, but into the future.
And that was Brianna Fiant from the Bong Veterans Historical Centre speaking with Carl Evans.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, cocoa farmers in PNG's autonomous region of Bougainville are giddy with excitement over the high prices of their cocoa beans, prices which they have never seen before. The spike in prices is due to the fall in cocoa supply from the biggest producers of cocoa in West Africa. Reports say cocoa beans are now selling for 4 kina per kilo. Cocoa production in Bougainville ceased during the late 80s. However, it has recovered thanks to assistance from Australia and New Zealand. Salome Irihata, Operations Manager of NGIP Agmart Limited, PNG's biggest cocoa buyer and exporter.
The cocoa industry in Bougainville and Papua New Guinea is probably one of the biggest employers of farmers in the country and in Bougainville as well, yes. Most of the farmers rely mainly on cocoa and copra, but mostly it's cocoa. Throughout the three regions in Bougainville, the population rely on for their economic sustenance. During the crisis, because of the blockade, like everything else, it was impacted. There wasn't much cacao coming out from Bougainville. But then after the crisis, people started getting back into it. And then, of course, the cocoa pod borer, which was imported from East New Britain, devastated the industry for a couple of years. The cocoa industry in Bougainville suffered. And whereas previously, before the crisis, we were the biggest exporter of cocoa. But thanks to the intervention of a lot of donor partners, Australian, New Zealand government, through all their various NGOs, and of course World Vision and all K International, they were able to revive the cocoa industry in Bougainville. And for the last 5 to 10 years, farmers have gotten back into planting the new cloned seedlings and hybrid seedlings, which has resistance to cocoa pod borer in a certain extent. And so the industry is now recovering. And we are now seeing the fruits of that interventions coming into fruition, meaning that this cocoa that was planted a couple of years ago by all these organizations is now in production, meaning that the farmers are now harvesting them.
We all know that right now, as we speak, the price of cocoa worldwide has just gone through the roof. What are the farmers thinking about that?
Sharon, I can tell you there's a lot of smiling faces around the place. People bring in 5 bags and they'd get like maybe 500 kina per bag previously, or even as low as 300 or 200. Now it's like over 1,000 kina per bag. So people are very happy with the price. And so you're seeing that like the non-believers in cocoa before, you know, a lot of people who used to criticize cocoa and just stick to coconut, you know, concentrate on coconut as their means of getting cash. They're now clearing new blocks to plant their cocoa. And I'm telling them, I don't know, maybe by the time your cocoa comes into production, the price should have gone down, you know. You should have been smarter like the rest of everyone and planted cocoa 2 or 3 years ago. Now you would be benefiting from this price. So, yes. And this is the true story. This is what's happening all over Bougainville. People are clearing blocks and abandoning their coconut plantations to clear blocks and plant new cocoa trees. So it's so funny, yes. Everybody is benefiting from this, and there's a lot of happy faces around.
Who's involved in the cocoa farming? Mostly men or mostly families? So what about women?
There's a cross-section of farmers. The women are involved very much in a big way. The intervention programs that, for example, the Wilbys and K International CSF, which is funded by DFAT, encouraging families to either revive their cocoa farms or plant new blocks. And in a way, you know, involving families means women and children and youth are very involved in a big way. So it's inclusive. It's not exclusive like it used to be before. Not that before was exclusive, but, you know, you would see, like, for example, for me, my father was one of the biggest cocoa farmers in my area when I was a young kid. So he was the one who did, you know, most of the clearing of the farms and all that. But, you know, my mother and us, the kids, used to assist him in planting and stuff like that. So I think the tradition still lives on. But now you have a more educated farmers who know what to do because of these intervention programs. How to manage their cocoa.
Salamiri Hatta, in Bougainville, some farmers are also now being involved in making chocolates, which is now finding its way to shelves overseas and in Papua New Guinea. Tell us about that.
These are small SMEs, you know, mainly mothers, cooperatives who are part of cooperatives or women's groups, who are working together to produce chocolates in their small kitchens, do downstream processing, because even though the price of cocoa is very high now, but with downstream processing, they'll make a lot more even from one bag. So it's not only women, but men as well. They're going into downstream processing, producing chocolate, cocoa powder, everything. And it's good to see a lot of supermarkets here selling, you know, locally made products. And it's very encouraging to see this happening because they're providing a market for, you know, these small groups who are producing such products here in a small way. So, yeah, it's very popular, downstream processing, not only for cocoa, but copra as well.
And that is a cocoa buyer and exporter, Salome Rihata. She was speaking there to ABC's Caroline Terriman.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Bobby McCumber, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between.
Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
That brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Solomon Islands officials saying polling was peaceful across the country, which saw many people vote for the first time, including John Amitau.
5 minutes to four and I just cast my vote. Yeah, feeling high. First time. I'm 55 years old, but it's my first time to cast a vote.
Well, you can hear more of these stories when you head to our ABC website. You can join us this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because news is next. And then coming up after that, it is Nija Daily. But I won't be back till next week. You will be in capable hands of Carl Evans, who will be coming through to present the show. It is my birthday weekend, so I'm going to be going away with family. But again, I appreciate your time this morning. This is Pacific Beat.